So the title of the topic is Rav of Soloveitchik and Constancy versus Change. Any organized religion is going to have to deal. Is going to have to deal with this issue. Organized religions, generally speaking, assume that there was some type of revelation way back when, some type of canonical text, some type of authoritative text that was written way back when, Chumash, Gemara, whatever it is, and times change. Society changes, technology changes, science changes, and there are major changes that happened in society in the last 150 years in particular. The rate of change is majorly accelerated. The question is, what do we, in a very broad sense, and we're going to get to particular nafkaminas in a second, think about change, not in terms of science, not in terms of technology, but in terms of the actual content of the religion. So this is going to be very broad. You'll see exactly what I mean in a second. But I just want to go through some general statements or Kluck and Soloveitchik have about change, and then we'll look at some specific nafkaminas. And on the surface, you might think that Rav Kook would be the conservative one. Rav Kook was the one who wore a spadak, who wore a kapata. His wife shaved her head. He had a nice long beard. He lived a regular Yerushalmi life after he moved to Yerushalayim and became the chief rabbi. And Soloveitchik, as you see in the picture, as you walk down Amsterdam Avenue, wore cool sunglasses. He wore colored jackets. He had secular education. He had a PhD in philosophy from the University of Berlin. Rav Kook never had a secular education, never had any formal credentials in that sense. You would think that Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke like six languages beautifully, would be the proponent of changes in some way, and Rav Kook would be the proponent of more conservative things. Rav Kook is generally speaking known for Zionism. That is a big change, a big new thing Rav Kook is a proponent for. But as we'll see, the roles are really reversed. I prepared this Mikaros very, very quickly, so they're a little bit out of order. If you look at source number three for a second, on page 3. Rav Kook's years, if I recall correctly, are 1860 to 1935. And I think during that time period, immediately after Kook was born, was when Darwin published The Evolution of Species. After Darwin published the book The Evolution of Species, Darwinism in general, the concept of biological evolution, societal evolution, was as Kook says, was going and conquering the world. And people had this notion that things were progressing. Things were progressing and things were getting better. What's the standard religious reaction to evolution, both Jewish and Christian at the time?
Negative.
The Torah says the world was created in 6 days. Evolution says these things developed over millions or billions of years. There's a direct contradiction, and you have to reject revolution. Again, there are ways to resolve the two things. Rav Kook is not talking about the direct contradiction between evolution and Bria's Olam. He's talking about the concept of evolution in general. Yeah.
But even within Rashi, like Rashi says that Cain and his twin daughter have twin sister and Hevel and his two the triplets. So Hevel became impregnated twice and gave birth twice within only a couple of hours in the first day. So you clear even within Chazal, like either reaction times are faster, or you're gonna say.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to deal with a particular issue of evolution in Judaism. I'm sure Rabbi Uderblank has sources in that if you want to ask him, if he doesn't deal with it here. But the concept of evolution, of things developing over time, something that was very important for us. Source number three, he entitled the feast Torah Tzitz Patzkot, or the student of Nazir entitled the feast, the doctrine of development, the doctrine of evolution. Rav Kook says as follows, Torah Tzitz Patzkot, the doctrine of evolution, ha'olakot mekubeshet et ha'olam ka'et, that is currently conquering the world, becoming more and more popular. It fits, it jives with the secrets of the world of Kabbalah. More than any other doctrine of philosophy. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist. If you could go through Rav Kook's personal first-person passages in his spiritual diaries, Rav Kook was mainly, he knew Shas Bal Peh, he was a major posek, he was gifted with a brilliant, prodigious mind. But if you asked him, if you woke him up at 2 in the morning, you asked him for his self-identity, he would say, I'm a Kabbalist. That's basically what he says. The stories are that in the Yeshiva of Elazhin, this is a story brought down in Yehuda Mirsky's, I don't think his book, but his dissertation on the early life and thought of Rav Kook, was that Rav Kook was in Elazhin for like a year and a half. He was there learning a lot. Somebody noticed, Rav Bengis, who ended up becoming head of the Eidah Haredes after Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, so he noticed that Rav Kook used to leave the Beis Medrash late at night, go to a side room, look at some papers, and come back. Good. In the Lashon at the time, there was a sure sign that somebody was involved with Haskalah. Why else would you leave the Beis Medrash, look at some papers in clandestine fashion, and then walk back? You're looking at newspapers, looking at secular literature. So one night, After Cook left the side room, he went in and he found the papers Cook was looking at. You know what was on those papers? Shemos HaVashem. Cook, as an 18-year-old, was already meditating, saying things about Shemos HaVashem when he was learning 16 hours a day of Gemara in Velashim. Interesting guy. But Rav Cook says the doctrine of Kabbalah, the doctrine of evolution, is the one that is the philosophical doctrine that fits most with the secrets of Kabbalah. Why? Evolution, development. It is constantly going in an upward ascent. It gives an optimistic foundation to the world. How could you give up hope? How could you despair if everything is constantly getting better? When you pierce the foundation of this idea of things constantly getting better, we're in source number 3, second paragraph. We find divinity, we find God shining very clearly. This doctrine of evolution, of constant ascent, sheds light on every single aspect of God's behavior with this world. Everything about the world is constantly getting better. Everything in the world, biological evolution, physically things are getting better, but also societally things are getting better. Rav Cook knew about the Gemara about Yiridas HaDoros, but in several letters tries to play down the theory of Yiridas HaDoros as much as possible. As we're going to see, on an individual basis, we are not as great. We're not as great tzaddikim as Rishonim. Rishonim weren't as great tzaddikim as the Gaonim or the Amorayim. But in terms of society as a whole, in terms of Klal Yisrael as a whole, things are constantly getting better. Things are constantly going up. One of Rav Cook's examples are in one of his letters. He talks about the fact that nowadays we all care about public education. All of us most of world history, nobody cared about these things. All of a sudden, we all care about public education. Why? Because you see, society is getting more moral as we go on. Nobody ever cared about nationalized healthcare. Nowadays, we're all debating whether or not whether or not the state, the people, should make sure everybody has all their medical needs taken care of. You see, there's some type of development in morality. I, the Holocaust, people are still very bad. Kasha Namesa, you have to know, Rav Cook died before the Holocaust. Rav Cook has this notion of things are constantly getting better. For Rav Cook, this is the meaning of tshuva. That God set the world on a one-way trajectory towards a tov mekla, towards the ultimate good. Things are constantly getting better. Each generation is one step closer to Mashiach because each generation is one step closer to those living out those divine ideals. Rav Cook was not the first one who came up with this idea. If anybody here listens to Moshe Weinberg, he often quotes Rishon Rav Tzadok that even though Yiridas HaDoros, in terms of the Inyan, I forgot the exact lashon. Inyan Toch Hanashama Sguli, some formulation like that. Things are constantly getting better. And I think Rav Tzadok says he heard this from his Rebbe. Who is Rav Tzadok's Rebbe? So he heard it from his Rebbe, and first he was very startled. It's like a very startling idea. And he says after he chazered Shas and post Gim Kabbalah again, he came across this idea many times over. Great. That's what Rav Tzadok writes. So Rav Cook and Rav Tzadok are very similar. There's Shnei Kohanim Gedolim. Rav Cook has this idea. Rav Cook identified this idea of Hitzalut HaOlam. I think it's constantly getting better. We'll see what that means in a second. It's one of the fundamental doctrines in his thought. When his student, the Nazir, asked him, Rav Cook, you're disorganized. I want to organize your thought. Around what principle should I organize your thought? Rav Cook mentioned Hitzalut HaOlam, the fact that the world is constantly getting better, as a fundamental doctrine of his thought. Good. Change is a good thing in certain ways. Look at source number 4. This is not a quote from Arizal Beitzer per se. It's from Chaim Seyman. Dr. Chaim Seyman is a law professor somewhere or other, I forgot where. He has an article called Legal Theology, which is a good analysis of Brisker Lumdus and Brisker in the theology that emerges from Brisker Lumdus from a legal theory perspective. He's a firm guy, he knows how to learn. And he wrote it's a very good article about Brisker Lumdus. He knows Birka Shmuel's, he knows Rabbi Hanan's. And he uses all these things to try to develop a worldview based on the Lumdus. So here's what he says about Brisker Lumdus. Because Brisker constructs his legal world to emphasize that halakha stands outside of time and space. Using the Chakira, the analyst transformed halakha from hundreds of technical details into abstract legal principles. Halakhic reasoning comes to emphasize the law's timelessness, coherence, and consistency. Things don't change over time. Each brisker move is designed to reinforce the image of an ideal and divinely given law, which, like the divine itself, remains pure, abstract, and meta-historical. Rav Kook is very into history. Rav Kook wants everybody to learn history. Rav Kook thinks you have to interpret history the same way you interpret Torah. You have to darshan history the same way you darshan Torah. If something happens to the world, you have to understand why it happened. What is the Yad Hashem? Understand why it happened and where the Yad Hashem is taking us. Halacha for briskers, for Rav Soloveitchik, is timeless. It's ahistorical. It doesn't get affected by history one iota. Let's see a quote from Rav Soloveitchik. This idea received its most eloquent expression in RJVS, Rav Joseph Yair Soloveitchik's description of his grandfather's method. Right, this is from Madodech Midot. This is from the Rav's eulogy for his uncle, the Brisker Rav, where he uses it as a platform to describe what his grandfather did to Lumbus. So this is the Rav about his grandfather, Rav Chaim. This is originally in Hebrew, but probably originally in Yiddish, printed in Hebrew, and then now translated to English. Rav Chaim fought a war of independence on behalf of halachic reasoning and granted it full autonomy. Any psychologization or sociologization of halakha strangles its soul, as such an attempt destroys mathematical thinking. If halakhic thinking depends on personal variables, it loses its objectivity and devolves into subjectivity lacking all substance. Rather, Rav Chaim provided for halakha specific methodological tools, created a complex set of halakha categories and an order of a priori premises through a process of pure partialization. Halakha is not conceived of in historical, political, sociological terms. Rav Chaim recoronated halakha with the crown of complete independence. Halakha has nothing to do with history. Same way science has nothing to do with history. The formulas that we use to create computers are the same formulas that always existed and always will exist. We just discovered them at a certain timeline, a certain time in history. But the ideas themselves, the facts themselves, the formulas themselves are completely ahistorical. Our history does not affect them whatsoever. The same thing is true with halakha, according to Rav Soloveitchik. And if anybody knows anything about Rav Soloveitchik, what are the ABCs, the foundational elements for Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy, so to speak? Lamdos, halakha. Rav Soloveitchik's big chiddush in the world of philosophy was that up until him, basically, what people explicitly said was that there are two worlds. There's halakha and there's makshava. What are the sources of halakha? Open up a Gemara, open up Shas, open up a Rambam, open up Shulchan Aruch. What are the sources of Jewish makshava? Something else. Svara, Kabbalah, Chassidus, something else. Rav Soloveitchik in the early 1940s wrote a book called Halachic Mind. It was only published later on in 1985, but he wrote it in the 1940s. And this comes out in many of his writings. He says that notion is a false notion. Really, if you want to develop an autonomous Jewish philosophy, what do you have to do? You have to act like a scientist. How does a scientist, what are the foundational elements of any scientific theory? Facts, data. What is the data of a religion? What is the data of Judaism? Halakha. So if you want to develop a philosophy of any topic in Judaism, your ABCs, your foundational elements, your ingredients are the halachos of that area. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, like the big Jewish philosopher, describes, and whenever he has a good story, he writes it in like 17 of his books. So this idea appears in many of his books. He says he came to America. He went on a pilgrimage to meet various rabbis, various religious leaders. He met two that changed his life in the late 60s. Who were the two? The Rebbe and the Rav. Great, perfect. He met the Rebbe, had a conversation with the Rebbe. The Rebbe told him how to lead. He met Rav Soloveitchik. Soloveitchik taught him how to think Jewishly. What was the conversation he had with the Rav? So he says he met the Rav outside of the Shiur room, I think, in YU, and they started talking about Jewish philosophy. Said the Rav asked him, "Have you read Heschel's book, The Sabbath?" He said he did. So he said, "How does Heschel describe the Sabbath?" He says it's a sanctuary in time. Romans and Greeks are very into conquering space, and Judaism is into sanctifying time. Great, shining, good kaddish. So the Rav said, "I'll tell you, it's a beautiful work of poetry, but it's absolutely nothing to do with the philosophy of Shabbos. Why does it? Why does it absolutely nothing to do with the philosophy of Shabbos? Because he doesn't quote any halakos."
Doesn't mention Isham Malacha.
Doesn't mention Isham Malacha. The philosophy of Shabbos has to start off with the Lama Tas Malachos. You don't start off with Lama Tas Malachos, you're coming from some subjective or personal experience, not connected with hard rock Judaism per se. You want to develop a philosophy of the shofar. Don't just sit there like Avsadi Gaon did and postulate 10 reasons why there's a shofar. There's a shofar to remind us of the Akedah. There's a shofar to remind us of Vimos Mashiach. No, go through the Sugyos in Rosh Hashanah, figure out what is the halakhic definition of a shofar. And what do you know if you go through the Sugyos in Rosh Hashanah? Halakha treats a shofar as a form of tefillah. Great. So then you can start philosophizing, what does it mean that a shofar is a form of tefillah? If you don't start off with the halachos, you're going to end up in some subjective land that's very far away from the bedrock foundations of Judaism. So for Rav Soloveitchik, two things are true. Number one, Jewish philosophy has to be rooted in halacha. This is true all throughout his writings. Whenever he deals with a topic, he always quotes Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Gemaras, halacha Gemaras as a basis for the philosophy. His book Worship of the Heart, straight up based on Rambam. His book on Out of the Whirlwind, Philosophy of Jewish Mourning, straight up Lundus. And then out of Lundus, he develops a philosophy. Halacha doesn't change. Philosophy develops out of halacha. What does that mean? Jewish philosophy, Jewish values, Jewish ethics don't change from time to time to time. Sociology might change. Certainly, you might have to apply halacha differently in a different metzias, like any metzias changes and halacha changes. But the halachos themselves, the bedrock foundations, don't change from generation to generation. Yeah. Sorry if I... Yeah,
how do we explain the presence of Agadata? What is
it's a good question. So they should explicitly ask, why are there narratives in Chumash? And he explicitly asks in Halachic Man, beginning of the second section, he asks that question. And then he also explicitly asks in a Yartzeit shiur, what's the purpose of Nach? Why do we have all these eschatological predictions if it's not halachic in nature? So he deals with it over there. Agadata, I don't know if he specifically asked, but you see he's thinking in that line, why do we need all these stories? Why do we need Nach?
He's clearly
thinking.
Shonen didn't feel this.
This is a question. So Soloveitchik explicitly critiques the Rambam in the book Halachic Man about this issue. But he thinks that implicitly the Rambam was doing this type of thing in Mishnah Torah. But when the Rambam was trying to write philosophy, he got caught up in some medieval snares and he went on a different era. From Soloveitchik, this is the way halakha thinkers always thought. It was just always implicit. Well, when people did philosophy, they put on a different hat and they did other things. For whatever reason, if you read the book Halachic Mind, you'll figure it out. In the 1940s, 1920s, 30s, 40s was the ideal time to really, truly develop an autonomous Jewish philosophy out of the sources of halakha.
The Gemara says, Rabbi Kiva, why are you being Hosek and Agada to go back to Olos?
Right. So
there's different worlds.
They're different. Yeah. So yeah. Gotcha. Well, it's a longer conversation.
Yeah. So the Rav Soloveitchik said that what we call today in the press Jewish values, halacha is the sum total of Jewish values.
Halacha, right.
Not whether we should. You know, whether we should allow Muslims to immigrate to the country is not a Jewish value.
Right, you have to know what it says in halacha, and then go from there. And we'll see specific nafkaminos in a second. Yeah, Ben. Sorry. Yoni, yeah, sorry.
In the introduction to Divrei HaRav, so Schechter also he talks about this idea, and he introduces it based on Rav Kook.
We'll see the differences in a second. Okay. And just in terms of this issue of development, Rav Kook did not think halakha was the sole source of Jewish philosophy. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist. He talks about. We'll see. Let's go on for a second. So we're going to go through maybe three nafkaminas of this idea. There are many, many more. And if you're familiar with these ideas, you'll see that different thinkers tend towards one side or the other, and a lot of contemporary conflicts or controversies in the community, or even from 30, 40 years ago, sort of surround themselves around this issue. The first nafkamina is going to be completely theoretical. It's how to understand the transition from Nevuah to Ba'al Sheni. If you open up Yeshayahu or Yechezkel, what topics are going to be discussed?
What is that?
Avodah Zarah, general morality, visions of Anachas Yamin, politics of the day. What is not going to be discussed in Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel?
Halacha.
No details of halacha. What is this? You open up Mishnah Gemara. What's going to be discussed primarily? Details of halacha. You don't find eschatological visions. You find some general statements about general values, but Gemara is predominantly halachic. What do we do with this transition from the Tkufas HaNeviim to Ba'al Sheni? We don't have traditions of halacha, or so many traditions of halacha from Ba'al Rishon. If you just open up Tanakh and read it, it doesn't sound like David HaMelech was—it's in time when the Navi presents us. David HaMelech was sitting there trying to tie his left shoe before his right shoe. I mean, the Gemara has complicated discussions between David and Shaul about kedushin b'pruta and things of that sort, but it's not explicit in the Navi. So what do we do about this? So, Reform Jews—we know what they do. They say that halacha was made up, you know, in the Ba'al Sheni era. Ezra came back, the Machadish Torah, and that's when the halachic system really starts developing. Let's look at past Rav Kook thought that this fault line between Nevuah and Ba'al Sheni represents a major fault line in Jewish history, and we'll see it becomes a model for the time period that Rav Kook was living in. Sorry? Rav Tzadok also talked about this, yeah. So Rav Kook, he has four essays. We talked about this. The shortest one is in a book, Arot Zera Nimsim, and Beis Chacham Adaf Minavi. Good. So we're going to go through passage pieces. This is the first source, the first page. We'll go through parts very quickly. Kook says, in the way of the world, it's the poets and the songwriters, so to speak, the writers, the artists, who describe beautifully the splendor of life. They describe the general beauty of life. They also know how to point out the general depravities of society and write against them. But actually deal with all the details. In order to actually come out with a detailed policy plan, it's how to get to that good and how to avoid that evil. It's not the job of the artist. It's not the job of the poets. It's the job of the people who are involved in more specific, more scientific disciplines. Right? George Orwell is going to write the book 1984. He's going to point out the general depravity of a totalitarian society, but he's not the one to come up with a specific plan for how America should deal with the USSR. Good. Next paragraph. The Malam is there, above this. The Nevuah prophecy saw the general ruination of Avodah Zarah, and they protested against it with all their strength. They saw the beauty of the life of Avodah Hashem, and they described it in such beautiful poetic terms. They saw the ruination of moral depravity. They saw how bad it is to oppress widows, to oppress orphans. And they try to inspire the masses towards these general values. Good. But what didn't they talk about? Halacha. Not that they didn't keep halacha. It wasn't the primary part of their Avodas Hashem. Their Avodas Hashem is much more general in nature. The small hairs that over time end up becoming much thicker. The small pieces of liquid that end up filling up cups. These are the things that are hidden from prophets. Etc. Details of halacha, which they kept, but wasn't what they got when they got up there on Shabbos morning and gave a drush on their shul. They weren't talking about tying your left shoe before your right shoe, coming on time to the davening. They were talking about the great beauty of the life of Avodas Hashem, and they're talking about the horribleness of Avodah Zarah and not being a nice moral person. Skip down, he has a whole description of what halakha does. But the great system of halakha, the underlying part, the end of the paragraph, this is not for a lower level Navi. Rukuk points out that Moshe Rabbeinu, writer of the Torah, the Chumash is the only book that we have in Judaism, up until Talmud Bavli to a degree, that synthesizes narrative and law. You have halachos and you also have stories. Nevi'im are stories or eschatological prophecies about Akaras Yamim or things about general Avodas Hashem and general morality. So Moshe Rabbeinu was able to see how these things come together. The pratim and the klalim, the details and general principles come together. Your average Navi wasn't able to see that, focused entirely on the klalim, the pratim, and the pratim would be emphasized. So for the great people like the Nevi'im, this was fine. You're keeping halacha. You're focusing on your zeal on Avodas Hashem and the great general principles, and that's great. What about the average person? The average person, you might hear an inspirational talk in shul, but at some point you're going to tie your right shoe before your left shoe. At some point you're going to wake up late for davening. Over the course of centuries and generations, what's going to happen is that if the father wakes up late for davening, the kid is going to do something worse. The next generation, next generation, next generation. And so what was happening at the end of Bayis Rishon? Everything the Nevi'im were talking about was being completely ignored. There was murder in the streets. People were dying in the streets out of poverty. People were the rich were corrupt and taking advantage of the poor, and people were worshiping Avodah Zarah. The great enterprise of the Nevi'im, which inspires Western society until today, ultimately failed in their own mission. What happens? Skip down to the next paragraph. Chacham Adaf Minavi. The Chacham Adaf Minavi. Mashalom asa nevua bechlima chamtach utzvim lahavot eish lebayar miyistrel vodazavivim. What Nevuah failed to do, the Chachamim, in a much more meager, much more modest way, by sitting and learning, sitting and focusing on personal responsibility for predictive mitzvahs, they succeeded in keeping Judaism alive in the way that the Nevi'im did not. Skip down to the underlying part. The object of the Knesset HaGadola set Judaism on a different path, emphasizing dictos b'mitzvos, emphasizing personal responsibility, emphasizing details and learning, and that's what created the framework to keep Judaism alive. For Rav Kook, he has four different essays where he describes the great fault line between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni. Here he's talking about Pratim and Klalim. In another essay, he talks about the nation versus the individual. And Bayis Rishon, almost all Skar Va'Onesh as mentioned, is national Skar Va'Onesh. You hardly find individual, you find it here and there, you hardly find individual Skar Va'Onesh. Everything is nationalistically oriented. Bayis Sheni, Mishnah and Gemara, who is the subject? Who is the Gemara talking to? Not the nation as a whole, it's talking to the individual person. You have a chiyuv to wake up in the morning. You have a chiyuv to tie your lapshu before you write you. The subject changes from the nation as a whole to the individual person. A third essay Rav Kook talks about is in terms of how do you experience God? What is the best way to connect to Hashem? Bayis Rishon, Rav Kook calls it hapsikia ruchanit, psychic spirituality, experiential. It's very clear. You open up a book of Navi, people experience God in a palpable way. You see Hashem, there are open miracles, there's such a proper practice. Bayis Sheni, all those things don't exist anymore. What does exist? Rav Kook calls, I think, ruchaniyut limudit, learning spirituality, academic spirituality. You learn Torah, you connect with Hashem. All these things shifted in terms of all these things were always present. In terms of the main focus of what Yadav was all about, it shifted from Bayis Rishon to Bayis Sheni. So Rav Kook is living in a time period when Jews are returning to Eretz Israel. What does he say? Look, skip down to the next paragraph. Eventually, people stop learning Navi. Navi was not part of the regular yeshiva curriculum. Navi and the ideas of the Nevi'im were not focused on in the Middle Ages past. The Nevi'im is stuck up. People started forgetting that there are general values in Judaism. People started forgetting about the Klavim. People started forgetting about the themes that were discussed in Nevi'ah. Therefore, nowadays, when Nevi'ah is returning, there's a different modality in Avodas Hashem as Am Yisrael returns to Eretz Israel and as the Geula proceeds. Then people are going to start hating halacha and abandoning halacha. This is Rav Kook's shot in sociology. This is why there's so many Jews leaving halacha in the late 1800s. Rav Kook was born in a time when the majority of Jews were shomer halacha. He died in a time when the majority of Jews in Europe were not shomer halacha. Why? Rav Kook says because it's a different time period, a different modality in Avodas Hashem. The same way Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni things shifted, Bayis Sheni, the Galus, to Geula, and the process is starting now in the early 1900s, things have to shift once again. We have to start reintegrating Bayis Rishon values into our Yadus. We have to start learning Navi more, thinking about Navi more, experiencing, talking about spirituality, and experiencing God in a personal and real way, talking about the nation as a whole, nationalism, Zionism. These things have to be brought back to the educational system. If you don't do that, if you just focus on the pratim, people who have different neshamos nowadays, they need something else, they're going to fall by the wayside. For Rav Kook, this notion of hitpatzchut, of development, is not just theoretical. Things change from generation to generation. And there are certain generations where things get accelerated. Rav Kook thought he was living in a generation where a major shift had to start to be initiated. Because it wasn't initiated before him, the majority of Jews stopped being shomer halacha. And he felt a responsibility, he who saw this, to sort of guide Yadus, guide Am Yisrael, back to reintegrate Bayis Rishon values into a Judaism that was filled with details, filled with halacha, and filled with individuality.
So he wanted to meld
the two. So that's Rav Kook, about the fault line between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni. Again, a major, major theme in his thought. I just want to see where Soloveitchik speaks. He doesn't talk about all these things in general, but he talks about the Anshei Knesset HaGadola in a couple of places. Just look at one place where he talks about the role of the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Look at the next page, Lonely Man of Faith, Chapter 7. Soloveitchik here in Lonely Man of Faith, Chapter 7 is talking about what he calls a covenantal community, where two people and God come together and they create a community. So what are the elements of a covenantal community? One of them is some type of dialogue between the people themselves and between man and God. what does it mean to have dialogue between man and God? For man and for a human being and Hashem to talk to each other? So he points out there are two ways to do it. There's nevuah, where Hashem talks to man, and there's tefillah, where man talks to Hashem. So if you look down in the top paragraph, and around four lines from the bottom of the top block over there, and this is on page two. Rav Soloveitchik says, right after the dash, it remains unalterably true that the very essence of prayer is a covenantal experience of being together with and talking to God. And then this concrete performance, such as recitation of text, represents the technique of implementation of the prayer, not prayer itself. The kiyum tefillah is amidah v'nei Hashem, like Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, and the ma'aseh tefillah is saying the words. Great. In short, prayer and prophecy are two synonymous designations of the covenantal God-man colloquy. Colloquy is a formal conversation. Prayer and prophecy by Yisrisho, prayer, which was instituted by whom? By the Anshin Knesset Gedola, are two sides of the same coin. There's continuity between what was happening at Tufas and Nevi'im and what is happening with the Anshin Knesset Gedola. Indeed, the prayer community was born the very instant the prophetic community expired. And when it did come into the spiritual world of the Jew of old, it did not supersede the prophetic community, but rather perpetuated it. We're not talking about a major shift. We're talking about Anshin Knesset Gedola perpetuating the same basic kiyum that existed in Nevuah after Nevuah stopped. For Rav Kook, why did Nevuah stop? Spiritual shifts in the winds of the world. The time magic stopped, Avodah Zarah stopped. All this experiential spirituality stops. Rav Soloveitchik, why does Nevuah stop? We have no idea. We don't question God's ways. But what we do know is that there's continuity between Nevuah and what comes afterwards, Tefillah. Prayer is a continuation of prophecy and the fellowship of the prayerful man and ipso facto the fellowship of the prophets. And he goes on to explain that's exactly why the Anshin Knesset Gedola from attacking our formal tefillos as soon as prophecy stopped, to perpetuate the same idea. So for Rav Kook, it's a major phone line, a major shift, which becomes the model for another major shift in his own time period. Rav Soloveitchik is, Anshin Knesset Gedola, doing that for the opposite. They're trying to perpetuate, to continue the same themes that existed in Nevuah in a time period when Nevuah is no longer there. Again, this is a theoretical nafkamina. There are no practical ramifications. It's a nafkamina for Havana, as you say. And for Rav Kook, this becomes a model for what has to happen as Bayis Shlishi starts getting rebuilt in his own time period. Let's talk about another practical nafkamina, the flip side of this, Zionism. Right? We're going to talk about Zionism, and we're going to talk about the idea of self-revelation, of talking about yourself, getting in touch with yourself, which is a pretty popular modern concept. So look at source number 5 for a second, page 3. Again, I don't want to deal with any specific hot button issues now, but just to try to create a general framework and hopefully a lot of the discourse in the different sectors of the community will fall in line. So if this is, I forgot exactly what page this is on, but as Rav Kook wrote this, it was published in Ma'amarei HaRiyah, which is different essays from Rav Kook. Rav Kook writes as follows: Jews are returning to Eretz Israel. Jews want to have political sovereignty in Eretz Israel. So what is the meaning of this? So both Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik were Zionists. They thought it was a good thing, and they thought Jews should have political sovereignty in Eretz Israel. Look at what Rav Kook writes. In Matzchiyah HaLumit, at the bottom of page 3, source number 5, if the national revival, Lo Tachadish Lanu HaRab HaTfilah, doesn't innovate for us something new about our davening, HaRab HaTorah, something new about the way we learn Torah, HaRab HaDarkim Masar Makshavat HaMunah, something new about the way ways of Masar, and then the way we're attentive to our faith, Inena Adayin Tchiyah Amitit, it is not a true revival. If this tchiyah lumit, return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Israel, doesn't affect every fiber of our spirituality, if it doesn't lift us up to high aspirations, etc., it is not a full, complete revival. Something has to change about the way we daven because we're back in Eretz Israel. Not because we're personally back in Eretz Israel, because Am Yisrael as a whole is returning back to Eretz Israel. Something has to change about the way we learn Torah, because Am Yisrael is returning to Eretz Israel. Something has to change about the way we have Musar, about the way we behave, ethical behavior, because we're returning to Eretz Israel. Again, we're talking about Hitzpatkot, development. Something shifts. In the Galus, people acted in a certain way. We're not talking about major shifts, where Kuk was very from. We're talking about certain attitudes, certain values, certain emphases that existed in the Galus have to be slowly moved away from as we get back to Eretz Israel. They served a purpose during the long galus, but now we have to do something slightly different. And we'll see exactly what that is in a second. you see how important it is for Rav Kook that the Tchiya Lu'umit has many, many ramifications, not just the fact now we're back in Eretz Israel. Look at source number six. This is probably one of the most straight up pieces about this. This Orot Tzchiya, again, this was published in the regular book Orot, which Rav Kook himself saw published during his lifetime. Around 2 weeks after the book came out, it was put in Chirim by the Gedolei Yerushalayim for good reason, because he says a lot of very, very radical things. But it's not like a book which was very par, which happened to put in Chirim because people were out to put things in Chirim. Maybe that happens nowadays. I don't know. But this book really does say some fairly radical things, and people who didn't like it put it in Chirim. So this is not one of the pieces that was called out in the Mechtav HaChirim, in the letter in the Kol Shofar, the letter which put the book in Chirim. There are other pieces that were more offensive, but just get the vibes of this piece. Orot HaTzchiyah on Pesuk Lamed, source number 6. Rav Kook says, Hineni ro'ah be'ayi, I see in my eyes, Orach Chayei Eliyahu Olah, the light of the life of Eliyahu is rising. Eliyahu, Redeemer of Mashiach. His power for Hashem, to Hashem, is being revealed. What is the clock of Eliyahu that is being revealed as Am Yisrael returns to Eretz Israel? HaKodesh Shebeteva Paretz Gedarav. The sanctity of nature is a bursting forth. It is coming to be reunified with that element of sanctity, the element of Kedusha that is above nature. For years, for decades, for millennia, we fought against nature, human nature, the natural world, and now finally we are victorious. Next paragraph. Hayadut shel ha'avar, Judaism of the past, Mitzrayim ba'hina, from Mitzrayim until now, Milchama arukahi neged ha'tava. We fight against nature. What does it say in the Sfarim of the Rishonim? If you follow your Yetzer Leim v'adam ra min urav, you're inherently bad. You're going to end up in bad places. You have to fight against your nature. You have to break your teva, break your nature, and rebuild yourself. It's one long fight against teva. It's ugly side of the nature of the humankind in general. We have to fight against our human nature. We had a fight against it. Nature has negative sides to it. But who nichna b'faninu? It is finally being vanquished in front of us. The worlds are getting better. Etc. So Rav Kook has this, one of the themes in Orot HaTzchiyah is the Kedusha Shebeteva, the sanctity of nature. Right? Rav Kook is his line, Kedusha Shebeteva, he Kedusha is Eretz Israel. What is the Kedusha of Eretz Israel when Jews return to Eretz Israel? It is the sanctity of nature. What does that mean? One level just means that you should go outside and experience the trees. I don't know about you guys. I went on more hikes in my 3 years in Israel than I've done the rest of my life in all of its entirety. Why? Because that's what people do in Israel. They go on hikes. They experience the nature. But much more important than just experiencing the natural beauty of the world is the nature of a person. How do I know what my derech should be in Avodas Hashem? If I'm naturally inclined towards learning Agadata, and I find it difficult to learn Lamdos, what should I do? So if you're in a yeshiva in Europe, 300 years ago, so the yeshiva is learning halakha, you have to learn halakha. Rav Kook writes that the teva of a person should guide them, again, within boundaries. You have to be a halachan Jew, you have to know what the boundaries are, but fundamentally, the teva of a person, the orientation of a person, should guide them towards their own particular individualistic path in Avodas Hashem. In the past, Rav Kook says that's not the way things were. Things were different. You couldn't trust the teva of a person. But after 2,000 years of distrusting teva, fighting against teva, breaking it, finally the Kedusha Sheva Teva, as Jews returned to Eretz Israel, is able to emerge, and we could start trusting our Teva once again. Again, was Rav Kook right? Was he wrong? Did his predictions come through? It's not the topic for now. But this is what he writes explicitly. Again, things are changing from generation to generation. Rav Kook was living at a fault line. Things have to be slowly moved in a different direction. For a sort of Kook Zionism, the return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Israel, the Tchiyat Lumit, is not just about living in Eretz Israel, Yishav Eretz, not just about getting political sovereignty and kind of the mitzvah of having Malchus Israel. It's about much broader change in the fabric of our Avodas Hashem. Rav Soloveitchik did not grow up as a Zionist. He says he spent many sleepless nights about his shift from Agudas Israel to Mizrahi. He says he only switched from Agudas Israel to Mizrahi because he feels like Hashem passing like Mizrahi because of the Holocaust. But Kol Dedido Fake is his big policy speech about Zionism. He says other things elsewhere, but this is what he said was going to be his big policy speech about Zionism. He starts off talking about the nature of suffering. How should we respond to evil? All of you're all of a sudden you're walking in the street, you get a phone call, and all of the doctor tells you you're sick. The doctor tells you a family member is sick. Something random happens. So it's a natural disaster, and your house gets flooded. How are you supposed to react to that? So Soloveitchik says that many people react to it by first getting paralyzed and then philosophizing, trying to understand why is there evil in the world, why is there tzaddik v'ra, and come up with some philosophy or some theodicy explaining it away. What does Soloveitchik say is the Jewish halachic way to do it? Again, halacha is the basis of the Jewish philosophy. Source number 7. He says, I am, however, interested in it from a halachic point of view. And as a person who wants to know what action to take, I ask a single question. What should the sufferer do to live with the suffering? In this dimension, the emphasis is to remove from causal and theological considerations, meaning from why this happened or where this is going, and is directed to the realm of action. The problem is formulated in the language of a simple halakha, and it revolves around a quotidian, a daily task. The question is, what does suffering obligate a man to do? This problem was a part of Judaism, which placed at the center of its Lashon Tzong, which placed it, meaning halakha, at the center of its worldview. Halakha is just as interested in this question as in issues of Esther and Hetzer, Chiyuv, and Betur. We don't wonder about the ineffable ways of God, but we have to know how to react halakhically when things happen to us. For Soloveitchik, the way a Jewish person halakhically should deal with suffering is the same way you deal with anything else. You wake up in the morning, triggers a halakha chiyuv, same with ani. You walk outside, you see a rainbow, it triggers a halakha chiyuv of making a bracha. If I suffer, triggers a halakha chiyuv of doing something. What is the halakha chiyuv of? What is suffering machayiv mean to do? Very simple. Look in the Rambam. If you suffer, what should you do? Tshuva, tefillah, become a better person. Become a more sensitive person to other people. Become closer to Hashem because of your suffering. That is how Jewish halachic response to suffering. Rav Soloveitchik then flips it. If suffering is machayiv me in a halachic way, good things are also machayiv me in a halachic way. That's the next page. Top of the next page. Judaism states that the kindnesses of God are not given to man as unconditional gifts without obligation. They require something in return. The very essence imposes a moral halachic demand upon man who enjoys them. Suffering is machayiv you to do something. Getting a good thing is machayiv you to do something. What is it machayiv you to do? Very simple things.
Give
tzedakah. Give hodah to Hashem. Thank Hashem. What are the next sections of Kol Bidu Dofeik? If it's not saying, the state of Israel is a good thing. It is a chesed that Hashem did for us. Why is it a good thing? Six knocks, you look it up in chapter 3, section 3 of Kol Dofeik. Because the state of Israel is a good thing, a chesed from Hashem, and chesedim from Hashem are a halachic mechayiv, what does that obligate us to do? To be Zionistic, to support the state of Israel. And when he doesn't say to make aliyah, he says to give money. The big punchline about making aliyah is missing from the speech. He says if we supported more yeshuvim, there would be less of a demographic problem, there would be less of a territorial problem, we would be able to fill up all of Israel, and we would have more influence about issues of state, and religion. But we American Jews are miserly, and therefore we're not giving enough money, and therefore we have all these problems. What is the whole context of Kol Bidu Dofeik? Is suffering is halakha mechayiv, chasadim from Hashem are halakha mechayiv, the halakha mechayiv me to do something. The state of Israel is a positive thing from Hashem. It's a chesed. It is halachically mechayiv me to do something. What is halachically mechayiv me to do? It's halachically mechayiv me to support the state of Israel, to thank Hashem for the state of Israel, support it financially, support it politically, and do all these things. That is the major policy speech for Soloveitchik Zionism. It's worlds apart. Again, you're supportive of the state of Israel. You are a religious Zionist. But for Rav Kook, the return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Israel represents its major fault line, its major shift in the fabric of our Avodas Hashem. Something different about our davening, something different about our learning, something different about our midos. From Soloveitchik, it's halachic mechayiv, which makes us support the state of Israel. Nothing changes about any other aspect of our avodas Hashem. Yeah.
They're not really in contradiction.
Not contradiction at all.
No.
It's not a contradiction at all. But I assume Rav Soloveitchik would find defense, or he would not find defense. He wouldn't like Rav Kook's formulations. But now we have to do something different about our davening, different about our learning. We have to change the nature of our avodas Hashem. Kook talks about learning more agadata, about being mechavera between agadata and halacha, Rav Kook talks about in terms of Talmud Torah. Whether or not he did these things is a different question. But this is what he writes about. He writes about not skipping agadic sikios, integrating agadata and halacha, integrating nevuah into halacha. He wrote a curriculum. He and a student in Nazareth together wrote a curriculum, the ideal curriculum for Merkaz Rav, which includes entire line of Mekubalim, the entire line of Jewish philosophers, all within the confines of the yeshiva. And all these things have to be in conversation with each other. The sugyos, the agadata, the halacha, the Jewish philosophy, the Kabbalah, all has to be intertwined in the base medrash. That's not the way things function here when Soloveitchik was in charge, in the least. So for Rav Kook, things have to change from the previous models, again, ever so slightly, slowly, to not go off the deep end, but things have to change ever so slightly because we're developing, because things are changing. Halacha is not changing, but certain values, certain emphases in our Avodas Hashem have to change. Rav Soloveitchik, that's not the case at all. Halacha is science. Science is ahistorical. Halacha gives you things happen in the world. They're machayim me to do certain things, and that's it. But Talmud Torah stays the same. Tefillah stays the same. Every other aspect of Avodas Hashem stays the same. But now we have an additional chiyuv to support the state of Israel and thank Hashem for the state of Israel. But it seems very, very different to me. Yeah.
Is there anywhere in Rav Soloveitchik talks about any other machayim, meaning like to bring about? You mentioned earlier about like malchus or like sovereignty, meaning
he talks about
it. Seem like you have a chiyuv to promote in a physical way any sovereignty.
So he does. So Soloveitchik, he does. I mean, he does talk about the answer to that question that we spoke about before about why are there eschatological predictions? Why are there nevuos but akras yamim and navi? Soloveitchik says it can't just be a prediction. It has to be a machayiv. So it's machayiv me to try to work out, to try to act such that these things will be fulfilled, to realize these visions.
By following halacha.
By following halacha. And if you have the ability, if you have a nevuah, which says there's going to be a completely moral society, and you have the ability to do that, then you have to try to do that as much as you can. So Rav Soloveitchik does talk about the ability to do more mitzvos in Eretz Yisrael, and he gave other speeches about Zionism, about why should we be supportive of the state of Israel. This was his major policy speech, and you see everything is couched in halachic terms. Nothing is changing about any other aspect of our Avodas Hashem. Yeah.
Didn't Rav Soloveitchik ever bring out the old Indian of mitzvos atluyos ba'aretz?
Yeah. So sorry.
Yeah, like Thomas and Marsos and things like that are. Maybe Minotaur in Eretz Yisrael today.
Yeah, so in another speech, he did talk about
the
fact that now there are more Jews in Eretz Yisrael, we have the ability to be Mekayim more mitzvahs that we were never Mekayim in the past. We haven't been Mekayim in the past 2,000 years. So that's also an aspect of Rav Soloveitchik Zionism. But this whole notion of where State of Israel is Rishus Mikosko Oseinu, which a messianic version of State of Israel, which for Rav Kook has other ramifications on our Avodas Hashem, is just simply not there in Rav Soloveitchik's book. One more nafkamina of these types of mindsets. We have how to understand the transition from nevuah to post nevuah yados, how to understand the transition from galus to state of Israel. For Rav Kook, it's a major fault line. For Rav Soloveitchik, it's not. Let's talk about something which is very, very different. Self revelation. You go through the drushos of the Chasam Sofer, you go through the drushos of the Beis Halevi. You don't find many anecdotes about themselves. You don't find them writing about themselves. You don't find them telling stories about themselves. In Sefer Chassidim, we find a lot of stories about the rebbes. You don't find a lot of personal first person biographies, autobiographies in Judaism. Right? We have. That's why people like reading what's it called, Tzav Zeros of the Yesh Kodesh, because it's again a first person spiritual biography, so to speak. I think Rabbi Tal wrote one, Rabbi Emden wrote one. There's a class here, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, about Jewish autobiographies, and you can count them on your fingertips, right? There aren't so many of them. Of Soloveitchik, if anybody's read through Soloveitchik's speeches, he didn't write an autobiography, but time and time and time again, he revealed his most personal emotions to crowds of thousands of people. You'll find him talking about the way he felt when his wife died. You'll hear him talking about the way he felt when he saw his grandfather of Chaim Daven Yom Kippur. You'll see how you'll see what his deepest fears are. He was very, very self-revelatory in his speeches, in a way that his parents were not. But he gave a speech about that also. He explained, why am I doing this? I forgot what I didn't put that on the page, but I forgot what page it is, but I haven't had a copy of the computer. So this is from Rabbi Rakefet's book. Rabbi Rakefet transcribed a lot of speeches Rabbi Soloveitchik gave, and he organized them in this book called The Rav. So here's what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. We're not going to read the whole thing, but we'll do highlights of it. Jews do confess, but confession is a... We're on source number 8, on page 5. Jews do confess, but confession is a private matter between the individual and the Almighty. In my opinion, this is because Jews' typical modesty and shyness. the noblest, the most exalted feelings that the Jew experiences must remain like the Ark of the Covenant concealed behind the curtain. Anything, again, starting with halakha, anything that's more kadosh in Judaism, anything that's more kadosh in halakha, is more hidden, more protected. The most kadosh thing we have, the lukos, the aron, is behind a curtain, behind two curtains in the Kodesh Kodashim, which only people only encounter once a year. And the curtain shall separate for you between the holy and the holy of holies. The sanctuary of the person is his emotional life, not his logical life. What is the Kodesh Kodashim of a person? His emotional life, the way he feels about other people, the way he feels about Hashem, his human experiences. The Ark is with us in each person's emotional life, concealed behind the curtain. This aspect of the human being is protected from the eye of the cynic, the glance of the skeptic, the ridicule of the so-called practical and realistic man. You have to keep your emotions hidden. Taking it out is going to be mezalzel in the kedusha of your emotional life. The Jew, as a father, never spoke of his love for his children. Never. I want to tell you something. My relationship with my father is very close. He was my Rebbe. I had no other Rebbe. Whatever I am intellectually is due to him. He was very close to me, and I was very close to him. There was an existential unity between us. Nevertheless, he never told me that he liked me, he never kissed me, and I never kissed him. I remember that on the occasion I was departing, and it was a downfall whether I would ever see him again, we just shook hands and said, go in peace, and let God be with you. As a matter of fact, someone watching this cold, chilly scene of the father and son parting said, that's first Columbus. Laughter. Please laugh. Sorry. The truth is that we did not spell out our love for our children in objective terms. Neither did Jews as husband and wife spell out their love for each other. No matter how much devotion, dedication, mutual trust, and love bound them to each other, they could not speak about it. This love was nurtured in privacy. Next paragraph. Apparently, the same method was applied in our relationship with the Almighty. We never told anybody and never wrote about our love and dedication for the Almighty. We have not told anybody about our great romance with the Almighty and his with us. There was no literature about this. The only book we have on this topic is Shir HaShirim, and it is couched in symbols. Only through such symbolism could our romance with the Almighty be presented. Jews, and this is, I'm not sure if this is historically true or not, but Soloveitchik is saying, Jews did not speak openly about their emotions. Their emotions for other people, their emotions for God, it just wasn't done. However, I do not believe we can afford to be as reluctant, modest, and shy today. Today we have to change. We have to talk about our emotions. We have to talk about how much we love Hashem. We have to talk about how much we love other people. We have to tell our children that we love them. Why is it different? Why? The reason is simple. In the past, the great expression of the tradition was not handed down from generation to generation through the medium of words. It was absorbed through osmosis, somehow through silence. When Jews were living in Europe, and they're inside an isolated Jewish community, and they grew up in that community, these things were gotten through osmosis. You grew up in a home, it was vibrant with the love of Hashem. Wasn't discussed, wasn't explicated, never articulated, no discussions around the Shabbos table about it, but it was there. What happens when Jews leave Europe and come to America? It's a breakdown of the Masorah. Kids today are not growing up in the same environment, not growing up with the same vibrancy, with the same type of environment. And therefore, what do we as rabbis, we as religious leaders have to do? Talk about our emotional life. Talk about how much we love Hashem. Talk about how much we have to love other people. Express ourselves more. Be more self-revelatory. Why? Not because it's good. Not because that's the ideal. The ideal is that it should be Kodesh Kodashim. We shouldn't be talking about this. But there was a breakdown in the Masorah in order to model for the next generation what a religious life is really like. We have to talk about it more. Who loves quoting this passage? Moshe Weinberger, right? He gave a speech in the 90s at the RCA convention about tefillah. He quoted Rav Kook, we're going to see about self-revelation. He quoted this piece from Soloveitchik about the need for rabbis to talk about their emotional lives, the need for rabbis to talk about spirituality, the need for rabbis to talk about things other than just strictly shatim nevarsha. But from Soloveitchik, you see, it's not because it's good. It's just because of the breakdown of the Masorah. We're living in America, so we have to do this. But really, it's Kodesh Kodashim. Let's just look at two short passages from Rav Kook, and then we'll call it a day. Rav Kook and Chadara. Again, this wasn't published. Rav Kook's personal spiritual biographies, notebooks, where he wrote down whatever musings he had, were kept under lock and key until the 80s. There was a scandal. They were publicized. They were published. So here's what Rav Kook wrote about himself. Source number 10. It could be that I write about myself. I have to write a lot about myself. And if I write a lot about myself, I'm going to be megala a lot of kiddush. Skip to the next page. Next page. We're gonna read this piece and be done in 3 minutes. Good, on time. Akuk says, "Banipasel Chagoba." Right? I am an exile. Who said I am an exile? Banipasel Chagoba.
Haskell.
Good. So what is this? Is a class of Hasidic tracts. I am an exile doesn't mean that I'm bago. Ania tnimi haatzmi, the essential inner I. It's very difficult for their inner eye to express itself. The inner eye is in galus, it's in exile, it's not there. Rav Kook goes through the major sins, the major chataim in Bereishis, and says, what is the source of each of these chataim? People lose themselves. Why does Adam eat an eitz hadas? Because he listens to somebody else. Why does Chava eat an eitz hadas? Because she listens to somebody else. What is Hashem's question to Adam and Chava? Ayaka, where are you? You lost yourself, you listened to somebody else. Again, your inner nature on its own should have been fine. You listened to somebody else, you broke your own teva. Teva equals kedusha in Gan Eden. That gets broken with the sin of the Eitz Hadas. And then, where are you? You lost yourself. Skip down to the second paragraph. Learned educators come. They look at the externals. They also remove the attention from the inner eye. Musifin teven al madura, and they add straw to the fire. Teachers come in; they teach objective information. There was no differentiated education, whatever the term is in Europe. They come in; there are 25 kids in the room, teaching all the same thing, and that's it. The inner eye is being lost. Next paragraph. Ruach apeinu mishia hashem zeu gvurata hadar gadol inu mevachutzlanu ruach apeinu mishia hashem. What is the beginning of the messianic process? Ruach apeinu. It's not external. It's developing the inner eye. As Hashem Elokeinu, David Malkeinu Nevakesh. El Hashem Beltovo Nefakeh. Es Ha'ani Shalom Shalom Nevakesh. At the same time we are seeking out Hashem, we're going to seek out that inner eye. At the Sminu Nevakesh in Himself, we're going to seek out ourselves and find it. Aser Kol Elokeinu Yikar. Aser Kol Zara Mamzer. Remove all the externals. Why? What are the last words? Ani Hashem. Because when you dig down deeply into the Jewish neshama or into the human neshama in general, what are you going to find? Ani Hashem, a spark of divinity which has to be expressed. This gets back to the teva point. In galus, the teva of a person is, again, I'm speaking very generalities, is bad. Has to be broken. You have to fix it. Once you're done with that process, the messianic process is the revelation of the inner eye, talking about yourself, not to the same degree. But the sense of finding yourself, of talking about your spirituality, like what Cook did in his spiritual biographies, constantly writing pieces in first person about his experiences, about his life, doing that type of search is something which wasn't done previously in Judaism, but for Cook is part of this messianic process. And so Soloveitchik did exactly the same thing, self-revelatory, but with what purpose? Because there was a breakdown in the Masorah, and we have to try to rebuild it to get to the point when our emotions are kodesh kanashim and they shouldn't be expressed. So think of this as like a lamed shashir. You have a chakira, hitzvat chot, development is good, or should things basically stay the same? Rav Kook thinks it's good in certain ways, obviously. Obviously, Rav Kook is the more dangerous philosophy. He talks about a lot about the dangers and the hesitations and the cautions you have to have. Three and a half kaminas, how to understand the transition from Bayis Rishon to Bayis Sheni, how to understand Zionism, the transition from Galus to living in Eretz Yisrael. Nafkamina number three, how to understand this concept of self-revelation, of talking about yourself, your own emotional, experiential life, which both Rav Kook and Soloveitchik did, but for very, very different reasons. Thank you so much, and v'yidlach zuvuk mar.